Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The FT.
Welcome to Banking Weekly from the Financial Times with me, Jennifer Thompson. Joining me in the studio today is Daniel Schaefer, investment banking correspondent, and Brooke Masters, chief regulation correspondent. This week, we'll take a look at ex-Barclays chiefs being named in the LIBOR case after a high court judge rejected their request to remain anonymous. We'll discuss the lack of regulatory coordination on so-called living wills, plans to ensure more orderly wind-down in the event of a bank's collapse, and the news that Bank of America plans to move part of its business from Ireland to the UK. And finally, we'll discuss ELTRA repayments and the news that European banks plan to repay more than a quarter of the first tranche of cheap funding they took from the ECB at the height of the debt crisis. But to start off, Barclays. Last week, the FT revealed that Bob Diamond, Barclays' former chief executive, and Gerry Delmissier, its former chief operating officer, were on a shortlist of 25 individuals who were detailed anonymously in regulatory findings as part of the bank's LIBOR settlement back in June. The document is part of a wave of court papers made available after former and current employees of the bank lost an application to keep their names private during litigation. Dan, what does this list of names actually tell us? What's its significance?
Firstly, I need to explain that what it doesn't tell us, which is it doesn't tell us that any of these individuals will necessarily have been involved in rate rigging or will have been implicated in any way. That's one very important point to mention. What it does tell us is that they have been mentioned in the settlement documents of the settlement we had in June, where Barclays was forced to pay £290 million for its part in the LIBOR rigging scandal. And that means they could have been mentioned because some of them did play a role in rate rigging, but also others could have been mentioned because they, you know, they were superiors and they were questioning something or any other email traffic or phone conversations they had. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is the whole ongoing trial did tell us in the past week something which we didn't know before about at what stage some of the most senior management actually seem to have had some sort of knowledge about what is going on. And we'd seen that through an email that was read out in court last week, actually before the list of 25 was published. And the email basically said, which was sent from a manager in the Treasury to a submitter who was asking about guidance, how he should submit the rates. The email said, and I read it out, guidance, if you can call it that, from the 31st floor is that we don't stick our head above the parapet in any circumstance. That was taken as sort of an instruction to basically not submit too higher LIBOR rate, because at that time there were some banks who sort of stuck out of the pack in the sense they might have been paying a higher rate, signaling that they would be in some sort of trouble. And Barclays was worried about them being singled out, having to pay too much in terms of their funding and therefore seeing as a weak bank.
And the 31st floor being Barclays slang for?
The 31st floor is Barclays slang for basically the senior group management, because that's where some of the senior group management offices, not all of them, but some of the, including the CEO, are based at Barclays headquarters in Canary Wharf. And in hearings of the Parliamentary Banking Standards Commission, we heard that in October 2008, there were first sort of instructions by senior management, in that case, Gerry Delmissier, who at the time was chief operating officer, who instructed bankers to submit lower rates. What we didn't know was that some of this so-called guidance was given already in 2007.
And of course, this case is interesting because it's the first of its kind to stem from the wider LIBOR scandal. In the UK, the bank is being sued by customers, including Guardian Care Homes based in Wolverhampton. Dan, can you just tell us quickly, why is this case so significant for Barclays and for other banks who could be implicated in LIBOR?
Basically, Guardian Care Homes is suing Barclays because they bought an interest rate swap that was pegged to LIBOR. And their argument is, if LIBOR was manipulated, then the whole LIBOR rate on which our swap was based has obviously been skewed and not in our favor, so we need to get compensation for that. And they are the first to sue a big bank in the UK on such an issue. If they were to be successful, then it could potentially trigger a lot of other customers coming out with the same claims, and potentially could be a very, very big problem for some of the banks.
But like all things to do with LIBOR, this could have months, if not years, to run. So we'll have to wait on the next stage of that case. On to something that's happening today. The Financial Stability Board, a group of central bankers and regulators, are meeting to discuss guidance on banks preparing living wills. These are resolution plans to ensure a more orderly wind down in the event of a Lehman-style collapse. But US regulators have warned the banks that countries may not work together to avoid the catastrophic failure of a financial group. Brooke, can you tell us a little bit more about this and whether or not it's a big concern?
Well, the whole question of living wills, which are also known as recovery and resolution plans, has been something that the global regulators have been trying to get banks to do now for 3 years. I mean, they were first asked to do it in 2010, and the UK is actually pretty far along. Its big banks have all written first drafts, as have all of the US banks. What's interesting is the U.S. guidance after getting everybody's first drafts on these plans was, guys, you've all assumed that we, the regulators, will solve all your problems and work out any cross-border conflicts. No. Go back and assume, what if we didn't work it out? What would happen next? The banks view this as catastrophic, saying, oh, my God, the regulators will never work together. This is really scary. I think the regulatory perspective is somewhat more nuanced, which is they would like to work together. In fact, the U.S. and the U.K. have done a pilot program to try to figure out how to work together. But they want to have a backup plan if it doesn't work. So I think over the next 3 or 4 years, there's going to be a bit of a tussle where the regulators say to the banks, we want you to restructure so that even if we can't sort everything out for you, the legal ramifications of a collapse would be manageable. And the banks say, well, that's forcing us to completely redo the way we do business, and you, the regulators, ought to be grown-ups and fix the problem. So it'll be interesting to see over the next couple of years exactly how this fight works itself out. Because, in fact, to do what the regulators want, the banks would have to completely redo their operations, or at least some of them would. And the banks, not surprisingly, aren't really excited to do that.
Of course, this was one of the topics at Davos last week, banks voicing concern over this disjoint on living wills. But for the regulators, I mean, what would their case potentially be? I mean, what challenges are they facing?
It's actually really difficult to deal with a very large failing bank because presumably it has played crucial roles in payments and deposit systems around the world. I mean, think about Citi. It was in 100 countries and is cutting back. It's disastrous to try and sort out if Citi in the U.S. is going down, what does that mean for Citi in Poland? I mean, the regulators are genuinely looking at very difficult problems. And solvency law in Europe versus the U.S. is quite different. In the U.S., it's very much if something goes insolvent, they want to stop it, cut it off, you know, end it, and let them restart. And in the U.K., and even more so in continental Europe, if there's an insolvency, they basically freeze everything. Say, everybody stop, we'll figure out who's owed what, and 5 years from now, everybody will get exactly the fair amount. And it's much fairer than the American system, but it does make it very hard to keep things going. The regulators also have this issue that if part of a bank goes down in a country that's not big enough to bear its problems, then it's really disastrous for that country. And we're starting to see that play out today with the news that Bank of America is going to move its $50 billion derivatives books out of Ireland into the UK. There's a tax advantage to Bank of America to doing this. And there's a regulatory advantage for both Ireland and the UK because the Irish do not want to be responsible for $50 billion of derivatives. They've had enough bank rescues and they certainly don't want to rescue some American bank. The UK, meanwhile, most of the derivatives come through the UK and they are actually managed out of the UK, but the actual derivatives themselves are in Ireland, which is kind of a difficult problem. They've had issues in the past where somebody misbehaves with derivatives and the UK has no jurisdiction over the guy who actually did the bad behavior because he's in Ireland, even though it's directed by a bank that's in the UK. And so they would like everything where they can get their hand on it. And they're less worried. The size of the Merrill Lynch derivative book is not that much bigger or smaller than Barclays. And so they feel a little more able to cope with it. That's actually probably something that's worked out pretty well, is that they've consolidated management with the actual book, which is good.
So will Ireland be happy or sad that this business has been transferred to London?
I think as long as they get to keep the people that go with the corporate banking arm, which they've said they're going to keep in Ireland, they're happy to say goodbye to the derivatives, which from their point of view is a lot of money running around with relatively few people attached to it. And it's the people that they want because they want the jobs and the employment.
And we now turn to a sign of recovery. European banks have pledged to repay more than a quarter of the first tranche of cheap three-year funding made available to them by the ECB in 2011 and early 2012. The longer-term refinancing operations led the ECB to pump more than 1 trillion euros into about 800 European banks. The first possible repayment date is later this month, January the 30th, for funds lent in the first tranche, totalling around 489 billion euros. Just under 300 banks are to pay 137 billion euros on that date, according to the ECB. Dan, does this come in ahead of expectations?
It's certainly quite a big number, but it's within expectations because analysts have been saying it's between 100 and 200 billion would likely be repaid in the first tranche. What I have to say, it's a very positive sign showing how the funding in Europe's banking world has improved since the first LTRO was set up. You have to remember it was set up at a time at the end of 2011 when basically the European bank funding market was grinding to a halt. There was a danger that some even slightly bigger banks might collapse because they couldn't find funding. And so it was a lifeline that was thrown to the banks. And now the fact that some of the mainly bigger, but also some smaller banks are repaying at least part of some, and some even all of the LTRO money, is a strong sign showing, you know, that funding has improved quite a lot. And it also chimes with what we hear in terms of anecdotal evidence from bank executives, that they are saying that they are actually now, some of them are flush with cash now. They've got more the problem of too much liquidity, which is part of the reason why some of them are paying it back, because although it's cheap money, it costs only 0.75% interest rates. Some of them had so much liquidity that they actually parked the LTRO money back at the ECB, where they don't get any interest.
The FT.
Welcome to Banking Weekly from the Financial Times with me, Jennifer Thompson. Joining me in the studio today is Daniel Schaefer, investment banking correspondent, and Brooke Masters, chief regulation correspondent. This week, we'll take a look at ex-Barclays chiefs being named in the LIBOR case after a high court judge rejected their request to remain anonymous. We'll discuss the lack of regulatory coordination on so-called living wills, plans to ensure more orderly wind down in the event of a bank's collapse, and the news that Bank of America plans to move part of its business from Ireland to the UK. And finally, we'll discuss ELTRO repayments and the news that European banks plan to repay more than a quarter of the first tranche of cheap funding they took from the ECB at the height of the debt crisis. But to start off, Barclays. Last week, the FT revealed that Bob Diamond, Barclays' former chief executive, and Gerry Delmissier, its former chief operating officer, were on a shortlist of 25 individuals who were detailed anonymously in regulatory findings as part of the bank's LIBOR settlement back in June. The document is part of a wave of court papers made available after former and current employees of the bank lost an application to keep their names private during litigation. Dan, what does this list of names actually tell us? What's its significance?
Firstly, I need to explain that what it doesn't tell us, which is it doesn't tell us that any of these individuals will necessarily have been involved in rate rigging or will have been implicated in any way. That's one very important point to mention. What it does tell us is that they have been mentioned in the settlement documents of the settlement we had in June, where Barclays was forced to pay £290 million for its part in the LIBOR rigging scandal. And that means they could have been mentioned because some of them did play a role in rate rigging, but also others could have been mentioned because they, you know, they were superiors and they were questioning something or any other email traffic or phone conversations they had. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is the whole ongoing trial did tell us in the past week something which we didn't know before about at what stage some of the most senior management actually seem to have had some sort of knowledge about what is going on. And we'd seen that through an email that was read out in court last week, actually before the list of 25 was published. And the email basically said,
support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next Five podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of The Next Five wherever you get your podcasts.
Which was sent from a manager in the Treasury to a submitter who was asking about guidance, how he should submit the rates. The email said, and I read it out, guidance, if you can call it that, from the 31st floor is that we don't stick our head above the parapet in any circumstance. That was taken as sort of an instruction to basically not submit too high a LIBOR rate, because at that time there were some banks who sort of stuck out of the pack in the sense they might have been paying a higher rate, signaling that they would be in some sort of trouble. And Barclays was worried about them being singled out, having to pay too much in terms of their funding and therefore seeing as a weak bank.
The 31st floor being Barclays and slang for?
The 31st floor is Barclays slang for basically the senior group management, because that's where some of the senior group management offices, not all of them, but some of the, including the CEO, are based at Barclays headquarters in Canary Wharf. And in hearings of the Parliamentary Banking Standards Commission, we heard that in October 2008, there were first sort of instructions by senior management, in that case, Jared Elmissier, who at the time was chief operating officer, who instructed bankers to submit lower rates. What we didn't know was that some of this so-called guidance was given already in 2007.
And of course, this case is interesting because it's the first of its kind to stem from the wider LIBOR scandal. In the UK, the bank is being sued by customers, including Guardian Care Homes based in Wolverhampton. Dan, can you just tell us quickly, why is this case so significant for Barclays and for other banks who could be implicated in LIBOR?
Basically, Guardian Care Homes is suing Barclays because they bought a interest rate swap that was pegged to LIBOR. And their argument is, if LIBOR was manipulated, then the whole LIBOR rate on which our swap was based has obviously been skewed and not in our favor, so we need to get compensation for that. And they are the first to sue a big bank in the UK on such an issue. If they were to be successful, then it could potentially trigger a lot of other customers coming out with the same claims, and potentially could be a very, very big problem for some of the banks.
But like all things to do with LIBOR, this could have months, if not years, to run. So we'll have to wait on the next stage of that case. On to something that's happening today. The Financial Stability Board, a group of central bankers and regulators, are meeting to discuss guidance on banks preparing living wills. These are resolution plans to ensure a more orderly wind down in the event of a Lehman-style collapse. The US regulators have warned the banks that countries may not work together to avoid the catastrophic failure of a financial group. Brooke, can you tell us a little bit more about this and whether or not it's a big concern?
Well, the whole question of living wills, which are also known as recovery and resolution plans, has been something that the global regulators have been trying to get banks to do now for 3 years. I mean, they were first asked to do it in 2010, and the UK is actually pretty far along. Its big banks have all written first drafts, as have all of the US banks. What's interesting is the U.S. guidance after getting everybody's first drafts on these plans was, guys, you've all assumed that we, the regulators, will solve all your problems and work out any cross-border conflicts. No. Go back and assume, what if we didn't work it out? What would happen next? The banks view this as catastrophic, saying, oh, my God, the regulators will never work together. This is really scary. I think the regulatory perspective is somewhat more nuanced, which is they would like to work together. In fact, the U.S. and the U.K. have done a pilot program to try to figure out how to work together, but they want to have a backup plan if it doesn't work. So I think right over the next 3 or 4 years, there's going to be a bit of a tussle where the regulators say to the banks, we want you to restructure so that even if we can't sort everything out for you, the legal ramifications of a collapse would be manageable. And the banks say, well, that's forcing us to completely redo the way we do business, and you, the regulators, ought to be grown-ups and fix the problem. So it'll be interesting to see over the next couple of years exactly how this fight works itself out. Because, in fact, to do what the regulators want, the banks would have to completely redo their operations, or at least some of them would. And the banks, not surprisingly, aren't really excited to do that.
Of course, this was one of the topics at Davos last week, banks voicing concern over this disjoint on living wills. But for the regulators, I mean, what would their case potentially be? I mean, what challenges are they facing?
It's actually really difficult to deal with a very large failing bank because presumably it has played crucial roles in payments and deposit systems around the world. I mean, think about Citi. It was in 100 countries and is cutting back. It's disastrous to try and sort out if Citi in the U.S. is going down, what does that mean for Citi in Poland? I mean, the regulators are genuinely looking at very difficult problems. And solvency law in Europe versus the U.S. is quite different. In the U.S., it's very much if something goes insolvent, they want to stop it, cut it off, you know, end it, let them restart. And in the U.K., and even more so in continental Europe, if there's an insolvency, they basically freeze everything. Say, everybody stop. We'll figure out who's owed what. And 5 years from now, everybody will get exactly the fair amount. And it's much fairer than the American system, but it does make it very hard to keep things going. The regulators also have this issue that if part of a bank goes down in a country that's not big enough to bear its problems, then it's really disastrous for that country. And we're starting to see that play out today with the news that Bank of America is going to move its $50 billion derivatives books out of Ireland into the UK. There's a tax advantage to Bank of America to doing this. And there's a regulatory advantage for both Ireland and the UK because the Irish do not want to be responsible for $50 billion of derivatives. They've had enough bank rescues and they certainly don't want to rescue some American bank. The UK, meanwhile, most of the derivatives come through the UK and they are actually managed out of the UK, but the actual derivatives themselves are in Ireland, which is kind of a difficult problem. They've had issues in the past where somebody misbehaves with derivatives and the UK has no jurisdiction over the guy who actually did the bad behavior because he's in Ireland, even though it's directed by a bank that's in the UK. And so they would like everything where they can get their hand on it. And they're less worried. The size of the Merrill Lynch derivative book is not that much bigger or smaller than Barclays. And so they feel a little more able to cope with it. That's actually probably something that's worked out pretty well, is that they've consolidated management with the actual book, which is good.
So will Ireland be happy or sad that this business has been transferred to London?
I think as long as they get to keep the people that go with the corporate banking arm, which they've said they're going to keep in Ireland, they're happy to say goodbye to the derivatives, which from their point of view is a lot of money running around with relatively few people attached to it. And it's the people that they want because they want the jobs and the employment.
And we now turn to a sign of recovery. European banks have pledged to repay more than a quarter of the first tranche of cheap three-year funding made available to them by the ECB in 2011 and early 2012. The longer-term refinancing operations led the ECB to pump more than 1 trillion euros into about 800 European banks. The first possible repayment date is later this month, January the 30th, for funds lent in the first tranche, totaling around 489 billion euros. Just under 300 banks are to pay 137 billion euros on that date, according to the ECB. Dan, does this come in ahead of expectations?
It's certainly quite a big number, but it's within expectations because analysts have been saying it's between 100 and 200 billion would likely be repaid in the first tranche. What I have to say, it's a very positive sign showing how the funding in Europe's banking world has improved since the first LTRO was set up. You have to remember it was set up at a time at the end of 2011 when basically the European bank funding market was grinding to a halt. There was a danger that some even slightly bigger banks might collapse because they couldn't find funding. And so it was a lifeline that was thrown to the banks. And now the fact that some of the mainly bigger, but also some smaller banks are repaying at least part of some, and some even all of the LTRO money, is a strong sign showing, you know, that funding has improved quite a lot. And it also chimes with what we hear in terms of anecdotal evidence from bank executives, that they are saying that they are actually now, some of them are flush with cash now. They've got more the problem of too much liquidity, which is part of the reason why some of them are paying it back, because although it's cheap money, it costs only 0.75% interest rates. Some of them had so much liquidity that they actually parked the LTRO money back at the ECB, where they don't get any interest rates paid on it. So they actually made a loss on LTRO.
And what about banks who won't be paying back the funds? I mean, the ECB did not disclose the identities of the institutions there were, but anecdotally, again, do you think we could be seeing evidence for two-speed recovery in European banks?
That's the other element of it. As much as there is a positive sign that for particularly the big banks, the funding has improved a lot, there's now the danger that LTRO will become what it wasn't supposed to become, which is a stigma. Because now there's the danger that those who don't repay, because they can't afford to, because they still, particularly banks in the south of Europe that might still not have access to the bank funding market, if they don't repay it, they could become stigmatized, which was why the LTRO in the first place was picked up by so many banks, because basically the ECB was pushing even the strong banks to take up LTRO funding in order to not make it a stigma. And that we will now might see happening, that some of the smaller banks are, you know, they are sort of stuck. They're still holding on to the LTRO money and they still can't access the general wider bank funding market.
And is it just a question of size or is there a geographic skew in all of this?
It's not so much a question of size as more of a geographic skew in terms of those banks that are based in the weak states of the Eurozone. The smaller ones there in particular have a problem, whereas some of the larger banks in those jurisdictions, they are even among those banks that are paying back LTRO because they got access to the funding market again as well.
And some analysts have said that banks in Southern Europe may be particularly likely to pay back a symbolic amount of money to, as you say, avoid this question of stigma. Well, next month, there will be an opportunity for even more banks to pay back even more funds in the second opening to do so. This week, we have the delight of Deutsche Bank's results, as well as a slew of Spanish banking results. And it just remains for me to say thank you to Daniel and Brooke for their contributions and to you for listening. Remember, you can keep up to date with all the latest banking stories at www.ft.com/banking. Banking Weekly was produced by Katie Carney and Connor Sullivan. Goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
I had some sort of knowledge about what is going on. And we'd seen that through an email that was read out in court last week, actually before the list of 25 was published. And the email basically said, which was sent from a manager in the Treasury to a submitter who was asking about guidance, how he should submit the rates. The email said, and I read it out, guidance, if you can call it that, from the 31st floor is that we don't stick our head above the parapet in any circumstance. That was taken as sort of an instruction to basically not submit too higher LIBOR rate, because at that time there were some banks who sort of stuck out of the pack in the sense they might have been paying a higher rate, signaling that they would be in some sort of trouble. And Barclays was worried about them being singled out, having to pay too much in terms of their funding and therefore seeing as a weak bank.
And the 31st floor being Barclays and slang for?
The 31st floor is Barclays slang for basically the senior group management, because that's where some of the senior group management offices, not all of them, but some of the, including the CEO, are based at Barclays.
/banking. Banking Weekly was produced by Katie Carney and Connor Sullivan. Goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.